Christine Bell. I'm here at McMaster University. And I'll be chairing the panel. And we've all agreed ahead of time that we're going to stick to the 20-minute paper and then 10 minutes of questions and discussion after each presentation. And we'll go in the sequence that are listed in your program. So, without further ado, we will start with Kit Pegley and paper Look, Another Wall, Retired Canadian Armed Soldiers on Music and Theatre and in First Deployment. So,
thank you. Although music played a highly important role in the lives of 20th century Western combatants, today's soldiers use technologies, including iPods, DVDs, CD players, on a daily basis, rendering music more accessible than ever before and allowing it to shape the soldier's sonic landscapes in considerably more personalized ways. Musicologist Jonathan Pieslak and folklorist Lisa Gilman have explored American soldiers' musical practices while serving in Iraq, particularly their preferences for rap and metal genres, and how they utilize this music while in combat. Beyond this work, however, little has been written on how or why deployed soldiers listen to particular musical repertoires, and even less information on their musical consumption practices in post-deployment. Further, to my knowledge, there's no research on the musical practices of Canadian soldiers, with an eye to how this information might improve their quality of life in theater or upon their return home. Research on how to improve Canadians' post-deployment mental health is clearly needed. As of March 2001, there were 594,600 Canadian Forces veterans, and this number is increasing. By 2015, Canadian veterans who served in modern conflicts, including Bosnia and Afghanistan, will outnumber World War II and Korean vets by a ratio of 3-1. According to Colonel Rakesh Jetley, psychiatrist and senior mental health advisor for the Canadian military, an estimated 8% of post-deployed soldiers suffer from mental health problems, and an estimated 25% of soldiers returning home from Afghanistan in particular have been reported to suffer from poor mental health and high-risk drinking. These are clearly staggering numbers. And over the past few years, I, the child of a Korean War vet myself, have wanted to explore how music might help us learn about the soldiers' traumatic experiences and how it may serve as a tool for their healing, or at least help them cope more successfully upon returning home. To this end, in 2012, I began conducting qualitative interviews with Canadian soldiers, and these retirees range from 28 to 56 years of age. We don't think of vets as being 28 years of age, but they are. And their tours span from Cyprus in the 1970s to Afghanistan in 2008. Questions I asked included, how did music help them grieve, cope, heal, escape, bond, unify, differentiate, and endure mundane, repetitive tasks while deployed? How would they describe their relationship with music since they've returned? Has their relationship with sound in general changed in any way? And today I want to tell you the stories of two interviewees, who I'm going to call Clay and John. And I want to explore what their relationships with music might tell us about their current post-deployment mental health, and how music might be used as part of a broader mental health promoting strategy for the Canadian Armed Forces. It's a very fancy first slide. Clay, now 52, was deployed on two tours. He first served as a radio operator in the Sinai Desert in 91-92 and in Bosnia in 95-96. And I just want to add, when you meet him, if you can picture radar from MASH, like doppelganger. And he was a radio operator. Whereas he described his first deployment as quiet, Clay's mental health suffered significantly in Bosnia and thus was then manifested in disturbing ways upon his return home from Canada. When Clay arrived home, he set up a cot in his bedroom closet underneath his clothes, the only place he felt safe, and slept there every night for about 7 weeks. He would get up each morning, put on his uniform, and go to work, an activity that seemed totally logical to him, although this petrified his wife and his family. Clay also needed to have a radio playing music with which he was familiar in the closet, a point I'll get back to in a second. Clay was diagnosed with a stress-induced disorder in 2000 and medically released from the forces in 2003. And I'd like to explore briefly three aspects of Clay's relationship to sound and music. First, he communicated to me that his psychological injuries left him scarred, in his words, way beyond PTSD. He now suffers from an acute adjustment disorder. In his words, PTSD is the inability to return to normal, and I don't have a normal anymore, end quote. His adjustment disorder is a chronic condition, although after 2 years of work with therapists and with a lot of medication, Clay is now doing much better. He attributes part of his healing to his relationship with music. Clay told me he's able to rely upon certain music, that is, music that can provide him secure relationships. In his words, quote, "Music provides a base. Music never changes. Buddy Holly will always be Buddy Holly. I don't have to adjust to that. Gives me the same old feelings every time I listen to him. I'm always looking for a way to anchor, to hold on to what I had, because out there it's scary, but I can be comfortable in here," end quote. For Clay, music was a lifeline. He also told me that music he likes is from the 1950s through the 70s, the music with which he's most familiar, the music he listened to before his first deployment to Bosnia, citing artists like Johnny Cash, The Carpenters, Bob Dylan, Elton John, Jim Croce. As he said, quote, "When I'm listening to music, to that music, it makes me feel very calm. I'm relaxed, you know, I enjoy it. I know it." And he was very emphatic with that. Clay explained this further, and I quote, "The response to trauma, it's a threat of some kind. You see the threat in changes of what's around you. I need things that I recognize so I don't feel threatened. I'm using threatened in the broadest terms, not threatened as though I'm going to die. Threatened as though there's something new. It's different. It's got to stay out there because I need to be in control of this area. New music scares me." Clay approaches music as many of us would encounter people, some of whom we may believe threaten our safety, while others appear friendly. In order not to be bombarded by insecure and therefore potentially threatening musical relationships, Clay limits his music to the repertoire that he knew before his deployment. As a result, the music to which he now listens is at least 20 years old. Second, I became interested in the ways in which Clay talked about his initial response to music he might overhear during the day. It's impossible not to overhear something during your day. I found it interesting that he described listening to music as an intellectual activity first, then an emotional one, and I quote, "If I can connect to that familiar sound, then I can connect through my brain into my feelings. I know a lot of people feel music and they can't intellectualize why they might like it. I do it the other way around. I think about it and then I feel it. So I recognize a song right up front and then I experience the feelings. I don't get happy and then say, hey, I know that song. I do it the other way around. Hey, I know that song. Hey, I feel good. If I recognize it and it's familiar to me, then I feel good. So it's almost a delay to say, do I know this? It doesn't just happen. I have to think music through," end quote. According to recent research, music has been shown to access pathways in the several areas of the brain associated with emotional behaviors, and this is not at all surprising to us here. If we agree with Stanley Schachter's cognitive theory of emotion, which posits that cognitive factors are involved in the perception of emotion, then I wonder if there's something we can learn from the way in which Clay processes music. According to Schachter, it is after we experience a physical arousal that we apply a label to that experience and know how we should respond. So for instance, if someone jumps out and scares us, our physiology is aroused, but the emotion we apply, fear, excitement, whatever, depends upon our past experiences, as well as the individual situation. Perhaps we can all remember here a moment when we were surprised and it took our cognitive minds and in turn our emotions a second or two to catch up with our aroused bodies. What would it be like then to respond to music cognitively and then emotionally each time we heard a piece on the radio in order to determine if it, like any other type of surprise, was safe? In his post-traumatic state, Clay seems to experience music much like he does an unfamiliar person. It is always a potential threat. This leads to another change, a final change in his relationship with music since returning home. Musical repetition serves as a comfort, and he can listen to the same CD repeatedly with reward. As he said, quote, "It's like a goldfish." This is the way he spoke to. He'd come in close, and he'd tell me, "It's like a goldfish, Kip. It's like I have a 30-second memory, and that's why I live in a small glass jar, and I go back and forth, finding a new wall each time. Look, another wall, look, another wall, look, another wall. I can play the same piece over and over again. It's almost like a limited-use memory. Once it's there, it's gone," end quote. To summarize then, Clay listens primarily to a dated musical repertoire with tremendous repetition because of the safety it provides. If, to cite R. Murray Schafer, hearing is touching at a distance, then Clay keeps unfamiliar songs a long and safe distance away. And my next fancy slide. John. My second informant, John, now 56, was deployed on four tours, three in Cyprus in the 70s and 80s, and one in Somalia in 92. He was only 19 when he was first deployed to Cyprus, and he was really enthused to see action and felt, quote, not at all afraid, end quote. He recalls that initially there was not much direct fire, which seemed to leave him and his colleagues a little disappointed, but this soon began to change. John recalls that as the conflict increased and his troop was increasingly popped up on adrenaline, they listened to music that fit their mood, especially that by Deep Purple and The Doors. Most of this music came via transistor radios and tape players, and he fondly remembers listening to these media while cleaning their kits and lying in their bunks. John identifies himself as having been a hype junkie, and when he returned from his tours, he had the feeling that he was invulnerable and wondered what possibly could render him frightened. Eventually, John did get scared, although it was not in response to the enemy he expected to face. One day in 2003, John experienced a panic attack. With buzzing in his ears and numbness in his arms, he felt like he was in an echo chamber. He experienced a sudden onset of tunnel vision, lost his peripheral vision, and didn't eat for 2 days. He slept and sat in silence. In his words, he lost everything. And after a month, he sought help and was placed on medical leave from the forces. It was hard for him and others at the time to understand what exactly had happened. They had heard of PTSD from soldiers coming back from Vietnam, but Canadians coming back from peacekeeping tours? Why would Canadians have that? John has since reconstructed his life, but it looks very different from his exuberant youth. With significant and ongoing therapy, he has learned to manage his external stimulation, and he now surrounds himself only with gentle stimuli. Not surprisingly then, his musical preferences also have changed. John discovered his new repertoire several years ago while in a therapy treatment program in Alberta. He borrowed a disc from one of his friends in the program, found the music soothing, and he's not been able to get enough of it. His favorites now include the Romanian pan flautist Zamfir and Enya. I won't play much of this because I'm sure all of you are familiar with Enya's repertoire. Let me just turn this down. Unlike Clay, who avoids more contemporary music, John has been able to adapt to softer genres and appreciates newer but very low-impact styles. When considered within the literature on music and mood regulation, John's preference for Enya is not surprising. Research has suggested that certain musical elements, such as smooth rhythms, are related to low arousal, and Enya's repertoire, with its gentle timbres and moderate and slow tempi, certainly fit this description. John, like Clay, is confined now to a limited musical repertoire, which in itself diminishes his life. But what are the possibilities for using music to actually rehabilitate his overall mental and emotional states? I believe one exciting avenue is the newly recognized relationship between music and brain plasticity, currently used to treat physical conditions like tinnitus or ringing or hissing in the ears. So for instance, the Tomatis method and Neuromonics tinnitus treatment incorporate a musical stimulation to the ear, so they put music in headset that is abruptly and unexpectedly interrupted, thus retraining and making accessible new neurological pathways. So your brain will then shift its recognition into a new pathway. So they create different pathways, and as a result, people with tinnitus are less aware of their condition because it's not relying upon the same old parts of the brain. New parts of the brain are being accessed and worked here. Could music be used similarly within an emotion-based therapeutic framework? This might involve a gradual exposure to the music the individual previously heard for shifting and used for shifting into happier and sadder states, as well as incorporating both high and low arousal repertoires. With time, the musical repertoires could become increasingly yet safely unfamiliar, helping the patient to open up new neurological pathways that might complement the existing ones. How the veterans own musical repertoires, not just stock happy and sad music chosen by the therapist, as is often the practice today, but personalized music from both the soldiers' peaceful and traumatic pasts could then help them recover from trauma is an unexplored area. But I believe this music holds therapeutic benefits. So sometimes music is previously chosen. Barber's Adagio for Strings is one of the stock pieces that is often used to induce a sad state. But if the soldier has no relationship to it, it can sometimes just fall flat. So how can we use the music that they know to be able to help them rehabilitate? These interviews have given me much to consider as I continue my research, and I hope it will have specific benefits when I eventually present this work to the Department of National Defense. First, I hope that this work will speak to the importance of music and stress reduction for military personnel. When new military recruits arrive at basic training in Saint-Jean, Quebec, their MP3 players are taken away from them, and they have the opportunity to earn the right to use them again. Sometimes that happens with their names as well. They're stripped of their name and have to earn the right to be able to use their name again. The wisdom of such policy is questionable, given that new recruits endure a lot of change when they arrive at Saint-Jean, and the training usually results in increased stress levels. I hope to convince the military that music is better used to prevent PTSD rather than help rehabilitate soldiers after they are already traumatized. Private music consumption at the end of a day would most likely lower new soldiers' anxiety levels, and we could help them develop strategies with music, sound, breathing, perhaps yoga, tai chi, that they could then take with them in theater to counter anxiety during their deployment and aid in post-deployment reintegration. I further hope that this work might contribute to discussions surrounding Canadian soldiers' actual role in international conflict, beginning with a discussion of the Canadian peacekeeper. According to an extensive 2008 survey conducted by Ipsos Reid for the Department of National Defense, the Canadian Forces is, quote, a brand with historical roots that Canadians clearly admire and respect. And the image of the Canadian peacekeeper in particular is one that has taken hold in the Canadian national psyche, end quote. According to the survey, 71% of Canadians see their military as a source of pride and cling to the romanticized notion of brave soldiers standing between belligerents. As one survey respondent commented, the international peacekeeper, the Canadian peacekeeper, is a non-threatening figure, quote, I do not picture a Canadian soldier carrying guns, end quote. This image, however, is outdated and not at all accurate. As Ian MacKay and Jamie Swift argue in their book Warrior Nation, Rebranding Canada in the Age of Anxiety, the image of the benevolent Canadian peacekeeper wearing blue berets and patrolling ceasefires no longer resembles the reality of the modern Canadian soldier. As the Canadian government has increased the frequency of active military deployments over the last few decades, it has become evident that the Cold War peacekeeper was entering willfully into international combat zones. All of the soldiers with whom I spoke agree that the figure of the gentle peacekeeper is outdated and unfortunate. As one high-ranking soldier told me, quote, it's crap, we're a war-fighting nation, end quote. Notice the change in colors as I now show you recent images from the Canadian Forces website. It's quite different. Our government, and particularly the current Harper government, has created a warrior nation, and we often don't like to discuss this. So how do we bring our gentle national mythology and a sober view of our current foreign policies into better alignment? How might this new understanding in turn help soldiers? Would they, like John, be more willing to reach out for help if we didn't keep telling them that first and foremost they are peacekeepers, but acknowledge that our government is asking them to be active combatants? What would happen if we also had more therapeutic interventions, including the arts, within the military structure itself? When I was first applying to do work with the Department of National Defense, I saw the emails flying by and they say, Pegley's survey, the little survey, right? So when they hear about music, they think it's cute. Now they become more interested in it because now they think it can actually benefit soldiers and it's inexpensive. If Clay's protocol included being introduced to new music in highly controlled environments, might this strategy lend some clues as to help him with other new experiences throughout his life? As I include these initial thoughts, I want to leave you with one of my interview hauntings. Some of my interviewees returned to Canada, left the military, and now work for Corrections Canada as prison guards. It's a very frequent second career for former military. One of these individuals, Chuck, he sat across from me at this interview in Tim Hortons. I've spent a lot of time in Tim Hortons. And he sat across from me and I said, let's talk about PTSD. He said, I don't get PTSD, I give it. And I believe him. Chuck told me difficult stories, though, of patrolling men in the Fort Saskatchewan prison, men that used to serve alongside him in the Canadian military. According to Chuck, these were guys who, upon returning to Canada, quote, just didn't adjust, end quote. I hope this research will eventually contribute to an ongoing dialogue between the Canadian military, civilian healthcare professionals, and artists, and perhaps give all of our returning veterans more hope for a livable future. Thank you.
Tremendously struck by the parallels you're drawing even before your closing image of some a conversation I had in an interview I conducted as an interdisciplinary basis on music listening in prisons. Mm-hmm. And I'm struck by the very strong similarities of the role of music in sort of easy transition in those places. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of music that sort of appeal. And thinking about, and I was reflecting on the military as an institution as well as a prison, and these very disciplinary orders, these total institutions as Irving Goffman would call them. It's a striking parallel. Neil explained it there.
No, it is. It's a really striking parallel. And quite often that a lot of things that initially happen within the structure, the institution of the military first, and then go on from there. So when you think about the Canada Pension Plan, that originally starts in the military. There are lots of medical technologies that were tested on military folks first and then go from there. To use their own music. Because as we're now, there's now this whole new area on neuroscience and neurochemistry. And in across these studies, what I've been finding is that when music is used instead of a benzo to help relieve anxiety previous to surgery, in pre-surgery situations, when they choose their music, not so much. When the surgical patient chooses their own, their anxiety goes way down. So that's one component of it. What we now need to do is, take that, bring it to the military where I actually can get quite a bit of support now that they take it more seriously, apply it within the military, and then we can go from there into prisons, into policing, into, I don't know about at the rest of your institutions, but anxiety levels at Queen's have been so big that they've been bringing in the puppies. This term, right? And I'm sure that I know they're doing this at Dalhousie, they're doing this at other institutions. So how can we then extend this to students, to any range, to seniors who are living with anxiety, and right? So for me, this becomes one place. And not to diminish, and again, I'm just really learning about music therapy, but the music therapy that's been implemented within the military has, to a large extent, been around drumming circles. And they're intermittent, so it's optional in these treatment programs whether they go or not. But if these people had the opportunity to be able to talk about their own music, because I go in and I sit and I say, tell me about, whatever, and they say, I've got nothing to contribute. And then you start talking about music, and as many of you know, boom, everything opens up, and the tears start to come out, right? So music is such an effective place, and if we can start with the military, I think that we can work out from there, including the prisons, where it's also desperately needed.
Thank you for the really, really nice presentation. In your the case as you presented, music is mostly seen as a soothing device or a therapeutic device. But I was wondering if there were those cases when music, since it's generally there's a strong association between memories and music, there was. Cases when the military the music was like more a negative something that was seen as negative by the
absolutely and. I have about, at this point, four or five papers, because another one, my next paper I want to do, is about the tank and all the different musical sonic spaces within one tank to build them up, right? So we have music to build up, we have music that in post-deployment, and what you're talking about here is also music and memory. So as I've been talking to the soldiers, one of the questions I've been asking is, are there sounds you can no longer listen to, or what are the musical triggers? And very few of them have any kind of sound triggers that they have to pull back from. The two that do exist are, one, silence, because if you're on base and there's total silence, no sound of generators, no sound of people moving, you're in big trouble. So they all have trouble with silence. And the second one is the sound of the bagpipe, which is not surprising. Because a bagpipe is the instrument used at the ramp ceremonies to be able to bring the bodies back up. And in fact, at RMC in Kingston, I was talking with some soldiers there a couple of weeks ago, and one of them said, ma'am? And I was like, yeah. And he said, when you mentioned bagpipes, and they were all kind of laughing in the back. And I said, what's happening? And he said, they had a football game there last year against one of the other, against Navy or something. And they were piped out by a bagpipe, and no one knew it was coming. And as soon as they started, everybody just tensed up, all the soldiers tensed up. And it was the only game in years where they've had a brawl, right? Because it just brought everything so far out. And I'm saying to the captain at that point, imagine we can learn and contain that, right? And learn to be able to work with that. This is more powerful than the drug. If you gave these guys drugs, they might not get into a a brawl, but like, look at what music can do in terms of changing their physiology. In that case, for a more aggressive, but imagine being able to bring it back down. So those are the examples of things that have really affected them sonically.
Thanks. It's a service mark along ideas, and I'm thinking about prison and relationships to music. I think your this emphasis on the push to the military that people need their own independence. I know that within the military it's the idea that you are one, but yet at the same time, all of these personalities, all of these people are so different and yet have very different kinds of responses. So to be yelled at, I can take, you can't take, like, all kinds of things. And so I'm wondering about this individuality, and I was thinking sort of these individual relationships to music and how much, from what you started doing, like how much the military is sort of taking that point kind of seriously. I'm also thinking about in relation to all of the music programs that are targeted at at-risk youth, and how, you know, for my experience, tons of stuff around hip-hop to indigenous and immigrant youth to at-risk youth, but what about those that hip-hop isn't their thing? And so how we're targeting and marginalizing it and categorizing groups of people, so the military, with certain sounds, whether it's India or, you know, rap.
And there are all sorts of course, as we would know, all sorts of different musical responses within the military itself, so that you have people who are listening to Breakfast, you know, they're listening to, I was saying, Breakfast at Tiffany's became one of the big songs for the Canadian soldiers. So while they might be listening to Metallica in some of the American soldiers' tanks going into war, the Canadians are listening to more acoustic stuff and they're more kind of laid back. So there's a whole movie here of all of this. But even within that, according to rank, gender, class, all of these different ways, so that in one tent you have one group of people listening and another one. But the other thing is that because they've got their iPods, as long as they're allowed to have their iPods, they're listening to whatever they want. So that's why the military just says, pull the iPods, because we can't allow for that kind of individuality, right? And one guy I was speaking to, they called, they said, we're going out outside the wire, which means that they were just about to go out, and he put on his headset and he just stood there, right? And that was just the biggest act of defiance, because the headset meant, I'm me, and I'm not doing that. So then everybody's headsets gets pulled. So yeah, you know, it is a big threat, both in terms of the music and also being able to talk about emotion, because my work went from a middle to a high level, intensity level, the highest level within military research, because in their words, I'm gonna talk about emotions. Right, and that's much more threatening. So it's a sticking point. On the one hand, it's a contradiction. On the one hand, it's dangerous. On the other hand, it's just music. So the left and right hand don't often know what to be thinking about.
To jump in again, I think the headset is also a critical thing, because I think Michael Bull's work on mobility and mobile listening, and I think one of the things that's so striking to me about when you transition somebody into basic training or into an intake facility, if you're going into the prison system, is when that sort of like, that constant beat of music that so many people live with is removed. If you're rooted in that space without your own soundtrack and always amazing sound, I think that is that interplay between not just control of music you want, but that immersive kind of experience that you're accustomed to. I think that is that aspect.
Absolutely. And also, what Michael Bull says about taking your home with you. When we go out of our homes, we take our home with us as an extension through the sound, and they don't want their homes coming with them. They want that to be a really fast chop. So anything that's going to threaten that is going to be taken away.
I think we're just about out of time for this question and answer, but maybe at the end, it would be great if we could take a few minutes and come back to talk across all of the papers. So thank you.
Thank you.